this morning is the Robert F. Booth Trust against Crowley. Mr. Frank, before you proceed, Mr. Bunnell, you should know that Mr. Frank is one of my former law clerks. I have done some investigation, and I don't think there's any reason why that fact recuses me. But you're entitled to that knowledge, so if you want to do some investigation, you're certainly welcome to, and you can let me know the results. But as I say, I don't think that this is a disqualifying fact. Okay? Mr. Frank.
May it please the Court, Theodore Frank, the appellant. I just want to update the Court about changes in the procedural posture of this case since the briefing concluded. As I predicted, the defendants did switch their position a third time. They have agreed to settle. The new settlement narrows the waiver, and otherwise, for purposes of this appeal, can be considered essentially materially identical. The major difference being that plaintiff's counsel is taking a fairly large haircut on their requested fees, which still are subject to clear sailing. For belt and suspenders reasons, I renewed my motion to intervene and renewed my objection just in case my earlier motion to intervene and objection weren't valid for the amended settlement. Plaintiff's counsel responded by saying, "This second motion to intervene is identical to the first motion to intervene that the district court has already denied, and this one should be denied for the same reasons." So if there was ever any argument that this case is moot, it's certainly unmoot now. And with respect to the main issue on appeal, I think that's a fairly straightforward one. It's Crawford 201 F3rd at 881 is dispositive on this, as is Synthroid Marketing. An objector has the absolute right to intervene, if only to preserve his appellate rights. Why we're still doing that is because of the case of Felsen, which is a pre-Devlin case following this court's then understanding of the Marino versus Ortiz precedent that an objector could not appeal unless the objector was a party, because only parties may appeal. Of course, the Supreme Court said otherwise about Marino in Devlin versus Scardelletti, 536 U.S. 1. And the entire underpinning of this court's requirement of intervention in Felsen has utterly disappeared. And while Felsen distinguished itself from Rule 23 cases, and Devlin's a Rule 23 case.
Has any court of appeals since Devlin considered the question whether 23.1 should be treated differently from Rule 23 for this purpose?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Quite frankly, it's economically irrational for anybody to pursue this on appeal. They can make a lot more money by settling. So these, which is why this is the first time this issue has arisen since Felsen, in this court. Going to the back to,
I take it that it's established, at least it's your view, that the fact that Felsen was affirmed by the Supreme Court doesn't prevent us from overruling it.
It was an equally divided court, if I recall correctly, and I don't think that should make a difference. I did not look at that question. I believe that the 4-4 opinions don't. There is no opinion. There's no precedent for future cases. The court didn't explain itself, obviously. What we're faced with here then is a strike suit, and this court has repeatedly recognized the economic problems of strike suits in the multiple Thorogood versus Sears opinions, in the Aquedots case, 654 F3rd, and in Felsen itself at 752. At 876. We have a case that was brought purely for the benefit of the attorneys at the expense of the shareholders. And I believe that 23.1A should be read to preclude a finding of adequacy of representation in such a case. And that's exactly what Aquedot says in the 23A4 context. I've delegated a lot of time for rebuttal. If you have questions, I'd love to answer them. Otherwise, I'll see what class counsel has to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Frank. Mr. Vianelli.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kenneth Vianelli for the appellees, plaintiffs. Your Honor, on Your Honor's question with respect to has any other circuit considered this issue after Devlin? And the answer is the Eighth Circuit did consider it in a case called Shirasinghe last year, but decided not to decide it. It decided that the district court was right in denying intervention and decided it was unnecessary to reach this other issue of whether Felsen was still good law, whether plaintiffs in derivative cases could appeal without intervening. Your Honors, the district court, the trial court's decision in this case should be affirmed. Mr. Frank didn't show entitlement to either mandatory or permissive intervention. His sole reason for wishing to intervene on mandatory grounds was that the plaintiffs should never have brought this case from the get-go, ergo...
That's for sure.
It is not, Your Honor. He called it a strike
ridiculous
suit.
Ridiculous lawsuit.
Respectfully...
Real abuse of the litigation process.
It is not, Your Honor. May I continue? It is not an abuse. This court itself is the leading circuit with respect to interlocking directives and Protecto Seal against Baranczyk, which the court decided in 1973. And it said that there were three good reasons why corporations...
Well, could you perhaps explain how this suit makes shareholders better off? As far as I can see, it deprives shareholders of the directors they wanted to have and entitles you to walk away with $1 million for injuring the shareholders.
First, on the money, Your Honor, our fee request is $175,000. It's one quarter of the lodestar we have in the case. It's a modest request. Secondly,
it's a modest request. No, not if you just hurt Sears.
Well, let me answer Your Honor's question with
what's
with
the benefit to Sears?
Three things. Three things that are laid out in this circuit's Protect the Seal case. One, no threat from the government. Two, no threat from the government.
Well, there are no threats.
It's
from
a complete emptiness, right? Not only is the government not threatened, but if the government did threaten, Sears could get the directors off its board. Your argument seems to be that in order to avoid the risk of a lawsuit, let's have a lawsuit with certainty. Well, that's a loss for the investors.
Your own decision says that's not true. The defendant in that case said that the relief was illusory, just like Mr. Frank says, because where is the government? They're not around. So what are you bothering for?
Yeah.
And this court, in the opinion, said...
Well, what is the answer?
The answer is should they wait?
Said.
Should they wait until Walmart hits?
When was the last time the government brought a Section 8 suit?
I guess the last time that I've seen it was in the Sears case. Sears itself was twice subject to government prosecution.
When was this?
1953.
1953. 69 years ago.
But if that's the point.
How about a little realism?
Well, how about Apple against Google?
Look,
I mean, that just happened last year.
What your business seems to be, or what this case, if you succeed in it, will generate as a new business for the nation's million lawyers, is hunting up conceivable violations by corporations and then suing nominally on behalf of the shareholders. And then they have to engage in investigations. They have to do this. They have to do that.
Well, let me answer that question.
I mean, what large corporation is not arguably violating one law or another?
Well, I don't think that's a reason why people shouldn't ask to have Section 8 enforced. to say that other corporations may be violating it, so who cares? The law is there on the books. We can enforce it.
But let me ask, thousands upon thousands of laws, and a smart lawyer can, you know, search around in a corporation's filings and this is and that's and so on, and say, well, I think maybe you're violating some law, and therefore I want a big fee in order to get this corrected.
Well, Your Honor, on that point, let me point out that the lawyers for Sears, one of the lawyers, the Sun and Shine firm, sends out a directory on its website to its clients saying, you should be aware of Section 8 of the Clayton Act and you need to be in conformity with it. And that's in the record. That's in the district court record, record 56. We put that in the record to answer the very question you're raising. Why should people comply with it?
Judge Easterbrook pointed out, what exactly is the what would be the difference between what you're doing and getting these directors off and what the government would do if the government wouldn't sue initially. They'd say to Sears, look, we think you've got an interlocking director, and so we're going to sue you unless you get rid of this director. So, well, Sears could do that at zero cost, right?
Yeah, it could wait.
Why not wait?
Why
would be the disadvantage of waiting?
The same disadvantage that Walmart has right now. They're getting blown out of the water because they didn't do anything about what happened in Mexico. So why didn't they wait?
That's an absurd comparison. If you think there's any...
No, the severity of what would happen to the company would be much less because this is a different kind of case.
There wouldn't be any scandal at all. Nobody knows about Section 8 or cares.
But, Your Honor...
It's not even clear there was a Section 8.
Your Honor, this circuit's own decision says that...
The reference to Walmart is really ridiculous.
The court's own decision in Protecto-Seal
really undermines your credibility.
The corporation is entitled to the legal tenure of its directors, even if the government didn't come in, and even if nobody brought a lawsuit. Your own decisions from this circuit say they're entitled to have compliance with the law.
Why? Does this harm them? Does an interlocking director harm a company?
The company has its own corporate governance guidelines on its website that says that we comply
with
the antitrust laws.
Look, I'm asking you, does it help or hurt a company to have an interlocking directorate?
I think it hurts.
Why?
Two reasons. One, they could be subject to giving away confidential information to the other company. That's what Protecto-Seal says.
The concern behind the rule against interlocking directorates is it's a way of colluding without being caught.
Well, that's the other reason.
Of course, can increase the profits of the company, right?
Illegally.
Well, make the shareholders better off.
The shareholders are not better off with the illegal profits.
Why not?
Why not?
Because they'd be, in other words, you're advocating a position.
Shareholders plainly are better off with a violation of the antitrust laws. That's why the antitrust laws were enacted. It's to prevent shareholders from making themselves better off by collusion. But that's the oddity of this suit. The antitrust laws are designed to rein in what companies can do to make themselves better off. But this is nominally, this derivative action is an action in which the shareholders say they've been injured by their board. No, the idea of the antitrust laws is that the boards and the companies are injuring the public. But you're not representing the public. You're representing the shareholders.
The shareholders have an interest in having legitimate management who plays by the rules. Their own corporate governance guidelines say that they do. To say that shareholders should invest in corporations that cheat and get away with it and profit is antithetical to every principle of corporate law. It may be that it increases their treasury, but to get it unlawfully violates their own...
So you would be filing this suit if what was going on was that Sears were granting quantity discounts nominally in violation of the Robinson-Patman Act, which the Department of Justice has not enforced since the 60s, and Sears are making a lot of money by granting quantity discounts... And you would be saying Sears has got to stop granting discounts to big customers and has got to stop making all of that money because of the Robinson-Patman Act. even though the Department of Justice thinks the Robinson-Patman Act is itself anti-competitive, which is why it won't enforce it anymore.
Your Honor, that's a totally different case.
But no, it's not a totally different case. On your theory, you can look for all those violations of the antitrust laws that the Department of Justice no longer prosecutes because it thinks they're wacky laws that actually injure both business and consumers, and you can collect a pretty penny for forcing firms to do things that injure their shareholders. That's what's going on here.
I wouldn't say that the corporation is better off for violating federal law, and neither did this circuit in Protectoseal in 1973, Your Honor. Your Honor, let me just close on Felsen, if I may have 1 minute. This circuit has not extended Devlin against Scardelletti beyond this narrow holding, which has to do with certified members of a class. No other circuit has gone as far as Mr. Frank asks. This court has had numerous opportunities to do so and has said that only in class cases, foreclosure sales, receiverships, and bankruptcy would a plaintiff would a shareholder or somebody else have a right to intervene. But otherwise they would have a right to appeal without intervening. Otherwise they would have to formally intervene. And the court has on all those occasions declined to extend Devlin beyond its borders.
We also said in Felsen, I thought clearly enough, that given the need for somebody to intervene in order to appeal, district judges should grant such applications freely. That's certainly not what happened in this case.
But that has only been in class cases where the shareholder.
Felsen was a Rule 23.1 case. That's where we said district judges should allow intervention freely.
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Oh, we didn't say that.
No, Your Honor, you said that in Crawford. And the Crawford case was a class action case. And the reason there's a difference is that the plaintiff in those cases, the petitioner is bound by the judgment. He loses his own rights. Here we're talking about only the company's rights, and that was the basis of Felsen. That's why the Felsen court said you have to intervene. It's not your rights.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Frank?
2 points very quickly. I think this court understands where I'm coming from. But with respect to Mr. Vianali's attempt to distinguish Felsen from the Crawford case, in this particular case, there is a waiver that binds all current shareholders. So if his argument is that Devlin only applies where interveners or objectors would be bound by the settlement, well, that's what this case is. Protectoseal is a 1973 case. It predates Brunswick, of course, so it predates a requirement of a showing of antitrust injury. But more importantly, it was not a shareholder derivative suit. It was a suit brought by the corporation itself as part of an internal control struggle when one of its competitors came in, bought up a bunch of shares, and got itself a board seat. The posture was different. There's no dispute whether the plaintiffs in that case were representing the interests of the corporation because they were the corporation. That's not what we have here. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Doesn't look like it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken up.